Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pot of thunder and rock and roll, and you know what we do on Fridays. Nothing until we hear the highly anticipated Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan calling. Listen, there was a guy out of my clothesline stealing my socks. I was going to go out and confront him, but I got cold feet. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Jeez. What a stinker. Duff is so proud of that one, too. But hey, cheers to Duff. He never lets us down on Fridays. Always calls in the jokes for almost 10 years now. It's ridiculous. We should put together a joke book. We have to go through and find all of the jokes over the years. But Guns N' Roses back on the road doing stadiums here in the States this summer. Go see him if you have the chance. And come hang with Quarantine as well. We've got some dates starting tonight, Friday, August 7th, Rochester, New York, Montage Music Hall. Tomorrow night, Saturday, August 8th, in Jordan, New York, at Keg's Canalside. I guess it'd be Canalside. And Sunday night, August 9th, in Irving, New York, at the Sunset Bay Beach Club. That's an early show. I think we're on at 6 o'clock that evening. Also, at the Joyland Country Music Nightclub in Bradenton, Florida, on September 20th. And, of course, we're doing the Kiss Cruise Landlocked in Vegas, November 15th, at the Virgin Hotel. Paul and Gene personally invited us back. And don't forget to check out the new Quarantine song out today on Spotify and everywhere else you get music, and you are going to love it. Quarantine.com with all ticket and VIP information. And yeah, it's going to be awesome. Come check us out. All right, Fozzy's also got a couple cool gigs as well. The Odds and Sods Tour, one gig every month this fall, September 4th in West Springfield, Missouri at the Big E State Fair. October 4th in Baltimore, Maryland at the Tailgoat. It's a tailgate party for the Baltimore Ravens. November 7th to 11th, Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. We'll be playing that, of course. Huge Rock and Wrestling Rager news coming out next week. And December 4th in Mexico City for the first time ever making our Mexico City debut. Can't wait to rock south of the border. We've been waiting a long, long, long time. That's at El Foro. Go to FozzyRock.com for all ticket and VIP information. All right, today, Jay Chandrasekhar, a.k.a. Thorny from the Super Troopers, is here. Super Troopers 3 finally in theaters today. And Jay's got the unbelievable story about how the original movie almost never got made, how George Clooney got involved after Jay was literally living in his house, and why one Sundance screening changed everything. He shares a completely insane story about directing Burt Reynolds under the Dukes of Hazzard. It's hilarious. Working with Chevy Chase on Community. I think he actually admits to getting him fired in a certain sort of way. And how he got the gig directing many Arrested Development episodes. Plus, we talk about the pilot that he and I were involved in that neither one of us even remember what it was called. But we figured it out. And we also talk about why R-rated comedies are finally making a comeback. The importance of movie theaters and the early days of Broken Lizard. It's a hilarious conversation with the very funny, very dry Jay Chandrasekhar right here, right now on Talk is Jericho. Okay, so we're here with, this must be something that people ask you all the time, the proper pronunciation of your name.
Chandrasekhar.
This is kind of like a Schwarzenegger type thing where I'm sure at first people were like, can you just change it to like Chandler or something?
Well, it's funny. I went up as a 19-year-old as a stand-up comic in Chicago under the name Jay Chandler.
Oh, wow.
Then I made it Jake Chandler. And then some lady's like, your name's Jake Chandler? I'm like, no. She goes, what are you doing? I'm like, yeah, you're right. So I went on, I made a headshot called Jay Chandras. And I'm like, what the hell is that? And I'm like, that's enough. If Schwarzenegger can do it, can do it. So now, I have the longest name in show business. By the way, Schwarzenegger is also the same, 13 letters.
Oh, wow. So there you go.
But, you know, my whole name is Jayanth Jambalingam Chandrasekhar. And it translates to victorious large penis rising moon.
Is it really a large penis?
In real life. And my father has Jambalingam, my son, my grandfather. It's okay. It's a family name.
So here's something funny. Not less than 2 or 3 months ago, Yorma Taconi was sitting here and found out that Yorma also means large penis Finnish or something along those lines. So I don't know what it is with you guys. What are we attracting here on Talk is Jericho? But yeah, a good friend of mine, Raj Sharma, he was a comedian, he just passed away, Raj Sharma.
I know that guy.
Yeah, he just passed away. He told me that all throughout school, the teachers just said, oh, we're just going to call you Roger. You can't be Raj. Yeah. You're Roger.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what you guys have to go through with these names, right?
Yeah. I mean, mine is, you know, J-A-Y-A-N-T-H. So it's J. It's pretty
easy. Yeah, it's
easily.
A good one.
But yeah, some of those, like Rajiv had to go as Roger, Roger, you know?
Yeah. You know? So we were sitting here, and you got here a few minutes ago, and we're like, have we met face-to-face before? And I told you I'd Googled to see if you did talk as Jericho. You hadn't. So I just text my manager, and I said, when did we work with Jay? Screwjob! Directed by Jay.
Screwjob.
Written by Peter Hoare.
Yeah, right, right.
Yes, do you remember this?
And it's, yes.
I won't read too much, but the log line, Johnny Doherty, Seek and Destroy, John Seek and Destroy Dalton, has always dreamt of big leagues of being a pro wrestling superstar, but when he finally gets to the big leagues, he quickly discovers his dream might actually be a nightmare.
Right.
So do you remember about this? We actually met.
Yes, I do.
Let's talk about this.
Didn't we try to set it up?
We did try and sell it.
Yeah.
And I think we even had a couple, you know, pitch meetings,
yes,
as they say.
Yes.
But where did this come from? Because I'm just trying to, like,
it came from Peter Hoare.
So, but Peter is, I know who Peter is, but a mutual friend, or he wants to approach me? Or?
You know, I just, because I make R-rated comedies, I tend to get whatever comedy script is out there that's looking for somebody to sort of run it through.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's me and Todd Phillips and Yorma and, you know, a couple others.
The bullpen, yeah.
But Peter, I liked, he was cool. He said he had this thing and, you know, you were attached and it was like, okay, let's give it a run. Like, show business is mostly, hey, let's give it a run and see what happens.
Right.
Mostly we, like I always say, show business is like a tiny island of yes in a vast ocean of no.
Yeah.
And so I've had, you know, like in a good year, I get told no 100 times and I get told yes twice.
Yeah.
You know? And I, you know, my wife's like, yeah, what do you know? I'm like, I'm succeeding.
Yeah. That's I use the line all the time, and David Arquette told me, he goes, this job is a series of rejections with a few gigs thrown in.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's pretty much nails it.
And if you can't handle rejection and go, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be in show business.
Right.
It's going to be, if you internalize that pain over and over, or if you actually, worse, if you believe that this one's going to work.
Yes.
You're going to pay an emotional price.
You're right, though.
Yeah.
And like you said, this is, you know, we're talking about the screw job pitch that we did, because it happens all the time. I've been pitching shows for years. And you get on there, and it's like you kind of go through it, and Jay will say this, and then I'll come with this, and then Peter will do that. And then you're like, there's no way they won't take this show. And then, of course, it's just so hard to get anything sold. And once again, it's something that you learn when you're in the business for a while. It's so hard to get cast in anything as an actor, as a director, as a writer. Like, to get some longevity in this business, which you have, is a pretty hard thing to do.
Well, you have to be like a deeply strategic person. You have to think like many moves ahead, and you have to like try to make multiple things at once so that, you know, you can't have your eggs in one basket. You have to have your eggs in 8, 10 baskets.
Yes.
And just be working it.
Right.
Constantly working it.
And that's the thing, too, is it's such a mind game, too, because you could be on a project and, you know, we'll talk about Super Troopers 3. You can finish Super Troopers 3 and it's like 2 months to film, for example, or whatever. And you've got a good budget. You got this. And the moment it's done, it's kind of like, what's next? You're like, we're kind of nothing. You got to start all over again.
Well,
right?
That can never be the answer.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, the answer has to be, well, I want to make this movie, so I'm going to make Super Troopers 3. And at the exact moment when the studio is most vulnerable, I'm going to spring it on them. And they're going to be like, boy, if we don't make it, then Sony's going to make it and we're going to lose out on the future. And they're like, ooh, you try to put them into a fear situation. Because when you don't have them in that situation, you know, they take you in the back room and they do what they want with you.
Right.
And you're like, and they do that all the time because they have the money.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you can leverage them a little, it's just, it's very rare. But, you know. Well, we're hoping we're going to get that with Super Troopers 3.
Well, yeah, and you've been able to do that just to get Super Troopers 3, because you were talking about longevity. Troopers 1, 2001, I think. 2 is like 18.
Yeah. 16, 3, yeah.
16,
yeah.
Whatever. It's 20. So you've got this three-part franchise that spanned 26 years. Now, in some ways, that's great. In other ways, I bet you wish you could have had three in the first 5 years after you made it. But what's the...
Well, they, you know, after we made one, they said, let's make two. And yeah. I was like, well, if we make two right now, we'll be the Police Academy guys who made 11 of those.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with those guys. Like, they did really well. But you would, we would have made, you know, seven straight.
Yeah.
And you'd only ever have done that. And you'd never get to do anything else. So we made a horror movie called Club Dread, which failed. But is enormously popular now.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we made Beer Fest, we made Dukes of Hazzard, and, you know, made a couple other films, and then we made Super Troopers 2. This moment right now, you know, we're coming out of a moment of intense fear in the film business. And that fear has manifested itself in basically kind of cowardice, right? So the studios are afraid of, you know, people are afraid of losing their jobs because the audience has not been going to the movie theaters for about 5, 6, 7 years.
Since the pandemic ended. Basically.
Everything original that was made was bombing. Good stuff, bad stuff. I mean, I made a movie with this huge comic, Joe Coy, named Easter Sunday. And it's like, it did okay. You know, Spielberg was producing it and it did okay. Because it was in that era of where the audience is like, well, we don't really, we're not sure if we like going to theaters anymore.
Yeah.
And the pandemic. And, you know, Netflix convinced everybody that straight to video movies were straight to streaming movies.
Yeah.
And somehow that's different. It's not different. It's a straight to video movie, right?
Right.
So it's like, it's we're emerging in this particular movie season. We have like, you know, that movie Project Hail Mary was a huge hit. This movie Back Rooms is a huge hit. This movie Obsession, a huge hit. Now, from young people, about young people, and you were like, oh God, the young people are going to the movies. Like, it's like a, you, we're in a moment where the wind is finally coming back behind the movie business. And then this weekend, Scary Movie 5, I think is going to make $52 million.
This is amazing.
I mean, it's an R-rated comedy.
Yeah.
Like, this is what we're trying to bring back with Super Troopers 3.
It's amazing, too. Like, there's still a prestige about being in the theater. And you mentioned, you know, the young people coming in. Like, when we were kids, the movie place was, the theater was the place to go for socializing and just to be out of the house.
Yeah.
I think kids still, no one wants to be home with their parents. Like, what are you watching? And it's like, oh, she started off. There's boobs on this right now. Whatever. So there is still a little bit of a freedom for the kids to go. So there is still a reason and a need to get a movie out in the theater.
Well, if you think about, like, what are the great dates for a couple?
Yeah.
Like, there's music, which is, you know, often a little expensive if you're going to some of these bigger acts. There's sports, which is really expensive, right? To go to like a football game or a baseball game. And, you know, and there's kind of the movies, right? And there's bars, right? Like, apparently this generation's drinking less.
Yeah.
Okay.
They're all on the weed, Jay. I don't,
okay, that's fine. As long as they're doing something. But the movies are generally speaking a lot cheaper. Like, we can't just not have the movies, right? Like, you can also go out to dinner, but that's about it. There are five things to do, you know, and the movies is one of them. And it's fantastic to go with, go on a date or go with your buddies.
Sure.
And
go with your kids. I mean,
go with your kids. It's fantastic.
Let's talk about Super Troopers 3, you know, and now you mentioned probably with 8 to 10 years later from 2. Why now? And was it easy to get it made? Were they waiting with bated breath for you to go, okay, we are ready for Super Troopers 3?
You know, number 2 was so hard to make because it was about 14 years after the first one. And so the studio is like, I don't know if your fans are still out there. Now, we live in the world, so we know our fans are still out there. But, you know, you got to remember, an actor who's recognized by one person doesn't mean that a whole movie is going to work. And so we were like, they're out there. I mean, we're doing stand up and it's, we're selling out, it's doing great. And they're like, we don't think so. Right. Or that's what our data shows, that they're not out there. Yeah. And you're like, okay, so we ended up crowdfunding that movie.
Oh, the second one.
Yeah. And
really?
we had 55,000 people gave us $5.5 million.
Really?
So we're the number 2 crowdfunded movie in the history of crowdfunding. The other one is Veronica Mars, which made 6.3 from their fans. And so once they saw that, Searchlight was like, oh, yeah, okay. And they got in and they paid for the marketing and gave us a little extra money. So, and then the movie opened to number one. And so they were, it was projected to make something like 3 or 4 million, according to their tracking on the weekend. And I think it made 15 and a half.
That's huge.
And they were like, oh, this is awesome. Right. But then when this one came around, it was in that period of fear where people had stopped going to the movie business, movie theaters. Mm. So they're like, well, I don't know. Now nobody's going to the movies. So we made it for, we made it for a perfectly healthy budget. I don't want to downgrade them, but it was hard. Mm-hmm. And then we tested the movie, and it tested the highest in Searchlight's history of any movie they've ever made for 30, 40 years having this movie company. We tested the highest. So it turned out well. It really did turn out well, and we're hoping people come to the theater to see it, but it was very hard to do. But by the way, every single movie is hard to do.
Sure it is.
You know?
Sure it is.
And hopefully what will happen is it'll do well, and I'll get to go make this Scottish golf trip movie that I've been trying to make for a couple of years.
Scottish? That's
golf trip movie.
Golf trip.
Yeah, like it's an original idea. Yeah, it's sort of, I have a feeling that what's going to happen in the movie business is that we're going to go through another period of this sort of 90s creativity where you can make indie films and small budget films, but new films with new ideas. Because I think the audience is like, I think that's what they kind of were hungry for.
And you just mentioned, Jay, if you're talking about Obsession or Backrooms, and I was in the Terrifier movies, which were very small budget.
Right.
And I think Terrifier 3 was a $3 million budget and did $100 million. Obsession is over that and Backrooms is over that. So you're talking about this 90s mentality of you could take a budget of $1 or $2 million, and if you do it properly and market it right and have something original, it could become a massive hit because that's almost the industry standard for a lot of these movies now.
Yeah. And what happened was, when I was in Sundance, it was like a year before me, Tarantino was there. Then I was there. Chris Nolan and I were in the same 10 directors to watch and Variety. Linklater was there before us. Like all these filmmakers who are kind of household names now came out of Sundance. And the reason they became theatrical filmmakers is because on their first movies, they were given a chance. Mm-hmm. And what happened with the streaming thing is that everyone's like, well, just shove it on streaming.
Yeah.
And see what happens. Yeah. We're not going to advertise it, and maybe it'll get an audience. And,
yeah.
But then that filmmaker is a straight-to-video guy. Hmm. And they keep sticking there.
Even in this day and age.
Well, instead of getting in the theaters and making all the money. If you make money in the theaters, then you're like, oh, this guy's a real filmmaker.
Yeah, right.
It's not fair to this younger generation is my point. But this weekend and last weekend are starting to prove it differently.
Yeah, it's interesting because you mentioned that. I'm thinking of during the pandemic, not Golden Child, what's Eddie's movie where he's the prince from Coming to America 2 comes out.
Yeah.
I actually really enjoyed it. But I haven't thought about it since then till you just mentioned right now. I was like, oh yeah, that was on Netflix or whatever. It was on Amazon Prime. And then it's gone. Like it just didn't even exist.
It's gone.
Happy Gilmore 2. It came out. There was a big brouhaha. Now it's like, eh. It's almost like you have to have that stamp of approval and be in the theaters to get that longevity.
Because in addition to being in the theaters, there's a trailer you see in the theaters. There's posters. There's talk shows. There's all the stuff
that surrounds it.
That makes you go, oh, this is an event.
Yeah.
Versus, it's over there on the streaming site. Check it out. And if you don't, it'll be gone.
Right.
Like Tarantino said that about these streaming movies. Yeah. He goes, did they even happen?
Right.
If they come, did they even happen?
He's right. Yeah.
And you're like, it doesn't mean they're not good movies. It just means, there's this feeling that promoting a movie is not worth the money at certain places. And you're like, then what do you have?
Yeah. But it's like you said, the theater is fighting back. Same like the vinyl albums, records are fighting back.
And right.
So let me ask you a question. You said you went to Sundance and being one of the top 10 directors to watch. What movie was that for and what year was that?
That was for It was for Super Troopers. And it was probably 2001.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
So talk about the Super Troopers concept and kind of where it came from. And that might stem from the Broken Lizard, you know, because you're from Chicago.
Yeah.
And Broken Lizard is the comedy troupe, which from the fine tradition of Chicago comedy troupes, I'm thinking SCTV and so many others.
Yeah.
You guys kind of created this troupe. And then where did the Troopers come from out of this?
Well, so we were... We had a film called Puddle Cruiser in Sundance as well, the year, like three years before. And Harvey Weinstein saw that film and was like, I'm not going to buy it, but let's make a TV show. We'll put on ABC. And then that didn't really work out. And he goes, I still love this movie. I'm not going to buy it, but I'll buy your next movie. And so we're like, okay. And so we meet with the head of production at Miramax, this great guy named Jack Lesher. And he's like, what do you want to do? And we're like, what should we do? And he goes, what do you mean, what should we do? He goes, and we're like, well, we made a movie, Puddle Cruiser, about being at college at Colgate, where we all went to school. Like, what should we do now? And he goes, you're supposed to tell us. He goes, I don't care. He goes, you can make a movie about a cat in space for all I care. Just come to us with an idea. We're like, oh, okay, great. So we spend the next 3 weeks coming up with a movie called Mickleberry Cat in Space. Okay. And we held the whole damn pitch about like this really smart cat who's going to be an astronaut, a catronaut, whatever. And the Chinese are like worried about this cat. They're like, oh my God. So they kidnap the cat. And then they realize it's just a dumb cat. And so then they let the cat go and whatever. It's this whole thing. The head of production is like, he's watching us. We finish the pitch and he goes, is this a joke? And we're like, no, you said cat in space. He goes, no.
Literally.
He goes, make a movie where you guys are in the movie. We're like, okay, fine. So now we're like, we don't have an idea. And we're like, we go up to a wedding in Vermont on the Canadian border. And it's literally like a lake that you can take a canoe across the lake and you're in Canada. Come back. Called Lake Averill. And we're driving back from that wedding, and we see a cop, Vermont Highway Patrol, has pulled over a couple teenagers. And we're kind of laughing because it was the time of gangster rap, right? Where like all these white boys are in the basement going, the police. Can you swear on this? And we're like, I bet that kid is like in his basement saying, you know, police. But in front of this cop, he's probably very like, polite, very, very polite. And we said, oh, that's kind of a funny dynamic. And then we were like, what if we made something where we're the cops, right? Or where we're the kids. We're like, ah, we should be the cops. And then we were like, you know, we could do a thing up here in Vermont. There's no crime up here. There's just nothing going on. And what if we made a thing where they have no crime, so they're trying to entertain themselves? And we'll put it right on the Canadian border. So we can make some, you know, jokes about Canada and whatever, you know, like, you know, there have always been a lot of Canadian references in Super Troopers. Because it's, you know, like in the first movie, they're kind of right on the border there. In the second movie, there are these Canadian Mounties who are like our opponents.
Yeah.
And in the third movie, I'll tell you a funny story. In the third movie, in like the second or third scene, I make a Canadian joke that is a little rough, right, to the country of Canada, a country that I love, right? I'm about to go there and shoot in.
I'm Canadian.
I know you're Canadian. Yeah. I know you're Canadian. Yeah. Well, one of the guys at the Toronto office of Disney saw the joke, and he goes, this movie shall not play in Canada.
Ooh.
And Disney's like, wait, are you out of your mind? Who do you think you are? What do you?
Yeah,
and so then they started showing to some other Canadians in the office, and they're like, are you kidding me? It's fine. It's a joke. And what happens is I make a joke, and then another guy makes some jokes. And then in the end, as we do, a very important Canadian comes through, and we're like, wow, we've learned a lot.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's an arc of a thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, I would imagine that people on the border have a little rivalry, you know, across the border. It's good old fashioned fun.
So that's kind of how it started. You said you saw these cops, and then you decided we can write a movie about these cops in Vermont.
So we wrote the movie, or so we pitched it to him, and the guy Jack is like, "Great, I love it." So we write the movie, and we give it to Harvey Weinstein, And he's like, he reads it and he goes, I don't know. I never know if anything's funny. Mm. He goes, it's just not my talent, but I guess it's good. I don't know. He goes, I'm not going to make it. And so he goes, but I'm going to give it back to you. He goes, normally I would stick it on the shelf and kill it. He goes, but I like you guys, so I'm going to give it back to you.
And that's something people don't know a lot of times. You sell a script to the studio, they send out to make it. It's done.
Often.
You don't get
it
back.
Because they don't want to get embarrassed by another studio making it.
Right. So they'll just shelve it and kill
it. Yeah. Right. So now we have our script and we're like, okay, well, let's try to get it made. So we go around to all the New York kind of, we're in New York at the time, the other production companies, October Films and Good Machine and whatever. They want to make a little more of an artistic kind of movie. A little more about sexual politics or, you know, abuse or whatever. Not these R-rated comedies. So nobody there wants to make it. So we go to L.A. and we immediately hook up with the Farrelly brothers. And they're like, this is great. We want to make this movie. They go around. They pitch it to everybody. No, everyone's like, wait, who's going to star in it? You guys? And we're like, yeah. They're like, nah, we're not making it. So then we get this Adam Sandler type producer named Bob Simons. He goes, I can get it made. He goes around, da 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 da. Can't get it made. Finally, we end up with George Clooney. And, well, I'll tell you the reason, because my friend Amy was George Clooney's assistant. And I met her on the first night I moved to LA. And she's like, I'm living in George's house and he's off making Peacemaker with Nicole Kidman. And it's a huge house and it's in the woods and I'm terrified. Mm. She goes, would you mind moving in? And I'm like, okay. So me and another guy from Steve Lemmy are living in George Clooney's house. We're in his slippers, his bathrobe, we're swimming in his pool, playing basketball for like 3-4 weeks. And he gets home and he goes, are you the guys wearing my slippers? We're like, yeah, baby. And he's like, and he goes, what are you doing? I'm like, well, we're making this movie. He goes, let me read it. He goes, oh, this is great. He goes, why don't Soderbergh and I, we'll come on board as your producers. Wow. We're like, fantastic. Let's make this movie. They can't get it. They can't get the money because it's us. And so we basically find one last guy who was back in New York. He was my friend's father who was retiring from being an investment banker. And he goes, I want to be in the movie business. I'm going to write movies. I'm going to make movies. And so his daughter's like, do you mind reading my dad's script? And I'm like, okay, yeah, I'll read your dad's script. And I call him up and I'm like, so you want to send your script over? He goes, actually, if you've written anything, why don't you send it to me first, just so I can see if I want to hear your opinion. And I'm like, oh, I'm getting auditioned to read the script. Okay. So I send him the script. And a week later, he calls me up. He goes, I read your script. I'm like, yeah. He goes, it's pretty good. I'm like, oh, thanks. He goes, what's happening with it? And I'm like, well, I mean, we're looking for $1.2 million. And he goes, all right, okay, I'll make it. And I was like, what? He goes, I have one condition. I heard you guys are associated with, I left a part out of the story, Jersey Films, which is Dan DeVito's company. Mm. They also tried to come on board to make this movie and they couldn't get it made, right? And so he was like, I heard you're associated with George Clooney and Danny DeVito. If those guys keep their names on the movie, I'll give you $1.2 million. So we call up Jersey and they're like, yeah, we'll do it. Fine. I mean, we just put our names
on. Doesn't cost them anything.
No problem. And Clooney was like, you have too many people. Just we'll bite. We'll jump off. You guys go make your movie. Mm-hmm. And we made the movie for $1.2 million. And it was, after that long journey.
Everyone's turning you down.
That's right.
Yeah. So when you finally, you get the money, but then how do you get it distributed? And
so then we're like, it's the day before Sundance. And I'm watching the movie at the lab, Duart Film Lab in New York City with my friend Kevin Heffernan, who played Farva. And the first movie started with a very slow opening 8 minutes really slow. So the audience is like, I don't know, maybe. And then it takes off like a rocket and everybody loves the movie. So the Super Troopers 1, we're like, we better make a really good opening scene. We better make it so that we can, it'll be funny right off the bat. And we're watching the scene in the lab, me, Kevin Heffernan, and the color timer. And I'm like, this opening scene is terrible. Like, I don't even know what we were thinking. Mm. This is just terrible. Like, we have to go to Sundance in like a couple hours from the plane. We're like, this is going to bomb. So we fly to Utah, really in a blue mood. Like, this is not going to work. This is a disaster. And we're now the screening is happening on Friday night at midnight. And we walk into a bar and there's Harvey Weinstein sitting there. And I'm like, dude, you own the movie.
Yeah.
We made the movie. It's great. Of course, I'm selling it. I'm like, it's showing up the street. Come buy it. And he goes, oh, I could come for 30 minutes, but then I got to go and then I can come back. He goes, everybody sees me leave after 30 minutes, your movie won't sell.
Hmm.
And I'm like, I'll put you in the back row. You can slide in, slide out. He goes, all right, I'll come. So the screening is packed with like really high young people. And he walks in and the whole place turns around, looks at him, is like, whoa, Harvey Weinstein's here. Wow. And the movie starts and it takes off like a rocket right away. I was wrong about the first scene. It's like I'm literally like crying tears of relief. And at about I'm pacing around the lobby, and about 30 minutes he goes, I'm leaving, but I'm coming right back. And he leaves and I'm like, oh God. And then he comes back. He goes, I told you I'd be back. Like, he's the, I know, like, I'm anti-rape and all that, believe
me. Of course,
of course. But so then he comes back in, and the end of the movie kills too. And at the end of the thing, he's like talking to me in a very public way. And he goes, I don't think I'm going to buy your movie.
Jesus.
He goes, but this conversation's going to help you. You watch it. He goes, in fact, come meet me at this bar down the street, and you'll be in page six tomorrow. And you'll sell the movie because of this conversation we're having, which is not a buying situation. Hmm. And I was like, oh, okay. And so as soon as he goes down the street, this other distributor goes, don't sell to Weinstein. We're gonna show our bosses. And it's like, the other ones are coming up to them. Like, don't sell to him. We're going to sell our bosses.
Snowballs.
Totally. Yeah. Then we go down there. We're in page six because they're like, Harvey Weinstein hobnobbing with the Super Troopers guys. And then by Sunday, it's sold to Fox Searchlight.
Unbelievable, right?
Unbelievable.
It's like the Beatles. They got rejected by 19 record labels and they finally got one.
Yes.
It's the same story with Super Troopers.
Yeah, and then this $1.2 million movie, we sold it for about $3.25 million maybe, and it made 20 in the theaters and so far about $150 million on home video.
Unbelievable, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting. That's what Yarma said about MacGruber when we did that movie.
Great movie.
Well, yes. I remember when we made it,
yeah.
He said, this is not going to be a hit out of the gate, but over time it's going to become, you know, a cult name. And that's exactly Super Troopers as well.
Movie,
it just ballooned. Like you mentioned, 150 million, you know, on the back end.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And it's still going.
So let me ask you this. When you had to make it the crowdfunded for two, did you have to make any concessions? And then like, what do you have to give your donors, shall we say?
Well, it was like a full-time job for the guy who ran the crowdfunding campaign. And we signed, I mean, I don't know, did we sign 20,000, 30,000 posters?
Yeah.
Like t-shirts and, you know, like there was like for $2.5 million, one of us would impregnate your girlfriend. Nobody bought that. But I mean, we were like, you know, we're trying to sell stuff. And we sold, you know, lunch with people and set visits. And some guy was an extra in the movie.
I was gonna say, yeah,
some guy
in the movie.
Spoke in the movie.
Yeah.
It made everybody who donated say, I own a part of that film.
Yeah.
And it was effective in terms of those people all showed up and brought people on their opening weekend and, you know, drove us to number one. It was amazing.
So then here we are now for Super Troopers 3 about to come out. What was the idea that you had to, what was it, a script-wise, a plot-wise, where you're, okay, now this is the time, here's what we got.
You know, the movie itself is about four highway patrolmen and a fifth one named Farba, who they don't like, and is like, really like a very kind of legendary asshole, but funny, but really an unpleasant guy. And so the concept of the third movie was, what if that guy, Farba, was dating your sister? And then we thought, nah, what if he was marrying your sister? And let's make it, you know, my character is this guy, Thorny, who the two of them are really always at odds. And So we said, oh, he could be marrying my sister and we'll bring in my parents and we'll make basically meet the parents, meet Super Troopers. And so the whole movie, I'm trying to stop the wedding. And he's, you know, he's actually in love and my sister's suffering from a thing called Putz-Fimmel syndrome, which is like a, she falls in love with her savior. He ends up saving her life in the opening of the movie. And so it's like a whole weird relationship happening in the midst of a crime story with a big Indian wedding. It's like a whole thing.
So you're excited about the concept of it?
And yeah. I mean, you know, I think our movies, those movies have been, you could argue that they're like sketch movies stitched together with some sort of crime plot. You could argue that. And I'd go, yeah, fine. We're a sketch group. This movie, when I listened to the crowd talk about it, there were a lot of women who were like, I was really kind of into the whole marriage and the wedding of it all. Not that women are only into marriage, but you know what I mean? It was like there was an emotional side to this movie that not only men, but women were really connecting to. And I was like, oh, it's because we have emotion and heart in the film. And I'm like, don't get me wrong. This is an R-rated movie with all the things you want in an R-rated movie. All right. It's, you know, it's got drugs. It's got booze. It's got R-rated jokes. It's got nudity. You know, it's got rebellion. It's like a good old-fashioned R-rated American comedy. Theatrical. But it also seems to have this emotional hook to it that we've probably resisted our whole lives because we're like, we're tough guys. How dare you? Like, we're tough. We're R-rated. We're not emotion. Dare you? And so now we now I'm like, ooh, you know, the next movie, the golf movie, I'm like, we got to put some emotion in this day. Well, I mean, it's connecting.
Right. So when the movie's about to come out and like it's playing in theaters or it's premiering or previewing, do you go sit in the back row, kind of hat low and see what the reactions are?
Yeah, you sit there and listen and kind of, you watch where jokes are like, you know, happening a little too fast or a little too slow. And then you go in and edit it and try to slim it down. And you put a microphone in there and listen to where jokes worked or didn't work. And you cut those out. The Fairleys would put a infrared camera on the facing the audience.
Interesting.
So that, because they had arguments about like, that's a laugh. They're like, I didn't really hear it. They're like, well, that's a smile. You can see them all smiling. So we keep that joke. You're, okay. So it's like you're doing stuff like that too. Like, because really what the audience is giving you is a very human reaction to a story. Like the lights are out. They're into it. And they're just reacting, right? They're like, they're a little bit like, you know, not, it's not that they're not in control, but they've kind of disappeared into the film if it's any good. And so you're getting this kind of primal reaction that other humans in the country will also react to. And Canada and other English-speaking places, they're all going to have this similar human reaction.
Yeah, and it's like we were talking earlier about how important it is to be in the theater. People tend to like, they might check their phones once or twice, but you're disconnected from the outside world when you're in the theater with the lights out. You're paying much more attention, right?
Yes, yeah. And I know, look, the big thing people say is, oh, I have a big TV in my thing. But you watch, you know, sometimes I'll watch my wife or somebody watch TV and she's sitting there going like this.
There's no skin in the game.
And I'm sitting there and she goes, wait, what happened? I'm like, you don't get to know.
Yeah.
Because you weren't watching. She's like, rewind it. I'm like,
Yeah.
Now I got to rewind it. And you're like, that's not.
Well, once again, you don't have skin in the game. You're just at home.
With a laptop open.
Sure. I mean, you go to the movies, you got to at least put some pants on or some shoes.
Right.
You got to go to the...
No skin in the game.
You got to drive there. That's you got to pay your $5, $10, $20, whatever.
And now you get your cocktail. You sit there, have a hot dog. I mean, you know, Netflix has, according to some of the filmmakers, has said, you know, you got to keep repeating the plot because, you know, people might miss it if they're on their phones.
Interesting.
And you're like, yeah, I mean, absolutely. That's a good strategy.
So with Super Troopers, you're writing, you're directing, you're starring. I mean, you're kind of a one-stop shop for this one project. Let's talk about more of just when you're actually just directing and not starring in it as well, because you've had Beer Fest and Dukes of Hazzard. I auditioned for both of those, did not get the parts.
Sorry, bro.
I want to know why. No.
Sorry.
But I mean, let's talk about Dukes of Hazzard for a bit, because that was a really big project at the time, because, and once again, you're a very young director, because that was, gosh, 2005, maybe?
Yeah, directed 2004.
Right, and this is Jessica Simpson, and it's in Knoxville.
Knoxville, and Sean William Scott, yeah. Burt Reynolds,
I mean, yeah.
Willie Nelson, wow. Joe Don Baker, Linda Carter.
Let's just talk about that for a bit, that list of names that you just gave. How was it when you're in charge of a Burt Reynolds and have to tell him what to do?
Well, I mean, I just wanted, look, first of all, I was a big Dukes of Hazzard fan as a kid.
Yeah.
And a big Smokey and the Bandit fan.
And just to say for people, like, we're approximately the same age. When we were kids, Dukes of Hazzard was the biggest thing ever.
Yes.
Everybody was riding their bike pretending it was the General Lee.
Yes, yes.
And everyone wanted to go, ba-da-na-na-na-na-na-na-na.
Yeah, right.
It was massive.
I had a Daisy Duke poster on my wall.
Of course.
In that moment when I was going through puberty.
Yeah.
This was important. And so they called me and they're like, hey, we want you to make the Dukes of Hazzard. But the script wasn't really, at the time, wasn't what I wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, nah, I'm not going to do this. So then a few months later, they call me back. They're like, we rewrote the script and we've doubled the offer. And I'm like, okay. So I read it again. I'm like, no, this is not, I'm not going to do this. I made these cool ass movies. I'm not doing this. A few months later, they're like, we rewrote the script and we've doubled the offer. I said, wait a minute. So you're just going to keep doubling the offer? They're like, well, we have more money than you have the ability to say no to. So it's time for you to come onto this movie and make it what you want it to. I'm like, okay, fine.
And this is because of Super Troopers.
Yeah.
They wanted the Super Troopers guy.
They want that vibe.
Yeah.
And look, the mustache I have in Super Troopers is sort of a tribute to Burt Reynolds.
Of course.
I kind of grew it with him in mind.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, okay, I'll make this movie on one condition. Broken Lizard gets to rewrite it, and we hire Burt Reynolds and Willie Nelson. And the executive looks at me and goes, to play the Duke Boys? And I'm like, no, man, but I would see that movie, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so they basically, I said, look, we got to hire as many Southerners as possible because, hello, I'm Indian. And the South is going to be like, what, you got this guy to direct it? Are you kidding me? And I'm like, but I mean, I wanted Southerners in it anyway, even though the original Dukes and Daisy and Boss Hogg, none of them are Southerners.
Mm.
Like, the original Boss Hogg was trained at Juilliard. Like, this dude's a northerner. And
like the guy in the TV show?
Yeah, yeah.
Forrest or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever his name was.
And Daisy Duke was a northerner, and so were the boys. But I'm like, we got to soak this thing in southerner. And so we got Knoxville. Sean William Scott is from Minnesota, so he's not a southerner, but he's
yeah.
a good enough actor. He was the one exception. Jessica Simpson is from the South. Willie, Burt. You know, Joe Don Baker, you know, Linda Carter's from sort of Maryland. Mm. And so, you know, Burt Reynolds was, he was an anti-authority guy,
mm.
right? And so on the movie, I'm the director, I'm the authority. Like when they called him and they said, hey, Jay wants to offer you the part of Boss Hogg. He goes, yeah, I'll do the picture, long as I can direct it. And they're like, oh no. Jay's going to direct it. He goes, all right, I'll do the picture. So then he shows up in his white Boss Hogg suit. And I'm like, this is the first time I met him. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is Burt Reynolds.
Yeah.
And we're shooting a scene in a jail cell. And it's Sean William Scott, Johnny Knoxville are in jail. And Boss Hogg comes to see them. 5-page scene. And I'm like, I'm running a rehearsal. And I'm like, he doesn't know a word of the script.
Unbelievable, yeah.
Of this scene.
Oh,
and I'm like, he's asking questions. Like, I'm like, I don't think he's read the script. I'm like, okay.
That's insane when you think about that, right?
Oh, yeah. Shows up.
Wow.
On set. And I'm like, oh boy. So I've worked with actors who didn't know their lines before, Chevy Chase.
Mm-hmm.
And the trick is you shoot the actors they're in the scene with first, right? So that the actor who doesn't know their lines can practice while we're shooting the actor who does know their lines. So I did that. I shot Johnny and Sean first. They did great. Bert's off screen reading, kind of learning, hopefully.
Smart.
We flip around, doesn't know a single word. And I'm like, okay. We're going to have to go line by line, just like I did on Community with Chevy.
Yeah.
I'm going to stand behind the thing and go, boy, you Duke boys are in a mess of trouble. Boy, you Duke boys are in a mess of trouble. And I'd say it five times. I go, Bert. And he'd go, we're not doing it that way. He goes, get me some note cards. And I'm like, okay. So we write his lines on the note cards, and we tape them to Sean William Scott and Johnny Knoxville's chest.
That's crazy.
Like this, boom, 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 boom. He goes, I learned that from Jimmy Stewart. And you're like, okay. He's just reading their chests, right? And I'm like, Bert, you got to look him up in the eyes. He goes, I am looking him up in the eyes, Orson. He started calling me Orson Welles day one. And I'm like, oh my God. And we end up getting the scene line by line, but we get it and it's great. And the next day he knows all his lines and he's fantastic, right? It's fantastic. And the next day he doesn't know anything. And it's going back and forth. He's supposed to come in. There's a scene where Linda Carter, he's supposed to walk in to say to Linda Carter, who's played Wonder Woman, he's supposed to say, oh, I like your hair. And he'll walk into the room, he'll look around, he goes, I like it here. And I'm like, no, you like her hair. And it was like that. It was like insanity. And,
wow.
Like not insanity, but just like nuttiness. And the other thing he was doing was he was punching the air by my face. Like, a lot, like just punching it. And I said to his assistant, I'm like, is he going to punch me? And he goes, I mean, I've seen it before.
Oh my gosh.
And I'm like, okay. So now I have a plan that I'm going to take. I mean, I've been a number of fights, right?
You're a big guy.
I could take, I've been able to take a punch, right? Yeah, so I'm like, I'm going to take this 7-year-old's punch and I'm going to grab him by the lapels and I'm going to lay him down. I'm not going to hit him in the face because I need his face. And I'm not going to dominate him because I don't want to hurt his feelings.
Yeah.
But I'm going to take one punch. I'm going to just put him down gently. And then we're going to get back to work.
Mm-hmm.
This is my plan. Mm-hmm. And the assistant goes, don't worry. His back is really hurting from all those stunts he did. So he really is probably not going to punch you because he can't take the physicality of it. And I'm like, okay. And so he doesn't punch me, right? So then we're like, we're going to shoot the scene with Jessica Simpson. And it's actually a big scene where like the General Lee is driving in a race. There are all these race cars, 20 race cars, 50 police cars, which we bought from Chris Nolan and Batman. We bought all the police cars, crashed them all. And I'm going up in a helicopter to shoot these cars driving around. Bert's on stage in like a white suit. And they're like, hey, Bert's back is hurting on the walkie. Do you mind if he goes home? And I'm like, yeah, put a stand-in in the white suit. Where I'm in a helicopter. Nothing, yeah. No big deal. So I fly around for 2 hours shooting all these cars driving around. And what happened on the ground is they said to Bert, hey, Bert, you can go home. And he goes, oh, good. Okay. And they said to Joe Don Baker, who was standing right there, he goes, Joe Don, you can go home too. He goes, I'll stay. And Bert goes, I'll stay too. So I'm flying around for 3 hours thinking there's a stand in there. It's real Burt Reynolds. And I'm like, you can't, he's this big. Okay. For 3 hours. Next day, I'm shooting a scene with Jessica Simpson and Burt. He hasn't shown up. And an assistant walks up, a 19-year-old kid. And he goes, Burt wants to see you in his trailer. And I'm like, okay. And he says to the producer, big, powerful guy, he goes, he wants to see you too. And he says to the assistant director from Texas, this guy, artist, he goes, he wants to see you too. Mm-hmm. And so we walk like a mile across the fairgrounds to his trailer, knock on the door. Bert kicks the door open and he's wearing white pants, a white tank top, kind of wife beater. He's got white hair here, but a black centerpiece toupee. And he goes, get the in here, right? And I'm like, ugh. And so we all roll in, including this random 19-year-old assistant, right? And he sits down and he goes, I saw your movie, Super Duper Pooper Scooper. And then there's a knock on the door and he goes, come in. And a nurse walks in and he stands up, pulls his pants and underwear all the way to the ground, points his butt at us. I saw his crunt, right? And the nurse injects him with a huge needle. And he goes, get the hell out of my trailer. And she leaves. And now he's sitting there like clearly wasted, right? On whatever painkiller he's on. And he's like, they say Demerol's good as Percocet. It isn't. Percodan never hurt anybody. Tylenol 3's for amateurs. And you're like, what's happening? Right? And Then he starts kind of pulling it together, and he goes, he looks at the producer, big famous producer. He goes, I like you. And he looks at the guy from Texas, the assistant director. He goes, I like you too. And then he looks at the 19-year-old who brought us in. He goes, I don't know you. And he looks at me, he goes, but I don't like you. He goes, you want to see a real movie? And he frisbees a DVD at me, and I catch it. And it says, Burt Reynolds, Why My Back Hurts. And he goes, get the hell out of my trailer. And so we're out on the trailer, and the assistant director is like, what do you want to do, boss? And I'm like, let's go watch a movie. So we go to my trailer, put it in. It's every stunt Burt Reynolds has ever done set to classical music. I mean, Smokey and the Bandit, Longest Yard, Sharky's Machine, and he's falling off buildings and he's rolling down hills. And you're like, and you can't help but go, the guy's a total badass,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I come out of the trailer, Jessica Simpson's standing there. She goes, are we shooting the scene or what? And I'm like, how am I supposed to know? And Bert walks out of the trailer behind her and he goes, roll camera. Like, we're a mile away. I'm like, okay, dude. We go down, shoot the scene. He knows every line. I'm like, how is this happening?
Yeah, yeah.
So on the final day of the entire shoot, we're like trying to shoot the scene in a barn. It's Willie, Jessica, Johnny, Sean, Joe Don Baker, and Linda Carter, and Bert. Bert cannot remember the line. He just cannot remember it. And he's like, at the end of the, he's like, oh. He goes, cut, goddamn stupid Indian. And then he looks at me, he goes, not you Indian, me Indian. I'm a quarter Navajo. And you're like, my God. And so then we finish the scene. Everyone's hugging goodbye. And I hug Willie Nelson, and I turn, there's Bert like this. Mm-hmm. And I hug him and he puts his lips by my ear. He goes, will you ever forgive me? Will you ever forgive me?
Oh my gosh.
And so I love the guy. I mean, I know he's dead, but I loved him. I don't know what to
tell you. Amazing story you just told. I mean, I'm still trying to figure all this out. The thing I love about this, and I noticed this when we talked on Screwjob, is that you have a very kind of understanding attitude, like just going with the flow, just the way you dealt with that and not getting super angry about it, but like, okay, here's what I'm given. We still have to make a movie, a picture.
Well, I have what I would call an assassin's attitude. I've been paid to assassinate somebody.
Mm.
Whatever happens in between is not going to stop me from this.
Gotcha.
I'm going to make this movie at a high level for the people in Burbank who hired me to do it.
Yeah.
And if that means I'm going to take a punch from Burt Reynolds and be insulted, so what?
So be it.
I'm the director of the Dukes of Hazzard. I'm flying cars. There's Jessica Simpson in that little outfit. Like, so what?
Yeah.
I mean, he would behave a certain way, and I'd look over at Willie, and Willie go,
yeah, yeah.
And we'd go back to Willie's bus and smoke weed and laugh. And he's like, how about Bert? And I'm like, I know, dude. And we, you know, like, it's fine. Like, people, you know, even with Chevy, like, he would say shit to me and you're like, it's still Chevy Chase.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm going to make sure in this movie that Bert Reynolds looks good.
Mm-hmm.
And that his lines are perfect.
Because that's the job.
That's the job.
Yeah.
And if it means getting punched, so what?
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned Chevy a few times. I remember where I've seen you talk about this was the documentary.
Yeah.
Which I watched. And I was like, that's, for some reason, I thought that you and I had that conversation on a previous episode. And I'm like, no, it was the documentary. And obviously, watching the documentary of Chevy, like, you can tell. He's basically admits himself that he's, you know, complete asshole, insane, whatever. Talk about working with him on Community, and it's the same concept. You have to make this show work, but it's probably very hard at
times.
Yeah,
like, you know, I was hired on Community, and Dan Harmon, who ran it, was like, he came to me before I shot the first day, and he goes, you a Chevy Chase fan? And I'm like, big time, big time. Like, I've even been called the Indian Chevy Chase in the New York papers after one of our movies.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that's true. It's just a funny thing.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm like a fan of Chevy Chase, right? I've been called the Indian Ray Romano, the Indian Bill Murray. I've been called it all. They can't just call me what I am, but whatever. So I'm like, yeah, I'm a huge Chevy Chase fan. He goes, you won't be tomorrow. And I'm like, I said, okay. He goes, yeah, he's a little rough on directors, so I just want you to be ready. He won't know his lines, and we'll take it out on you. And I'm like, dude, don't worry about it.
Now, is this pre-Burt Reynolds or post?
It was pre.
Okay.
I'm like, don't worry about it.
Yeah,
it's not a problem. And I mean, I went to meet him, and he was rough, and he was challenging. But I just did what I just told you. I read his lines 5 times and made him say it in the right rhythm. And he's like, how many takes are we going to do? I'm like, until we get one good one. And then we're going to go to the next line. And he's like, rawr. And, you know, like there were times I'm like, you know, you got to just pull the pause out between these two words because it's not the joke. It doesn't, the music of it doesn't really work with a pause in the middle of it. And he goes, oh, I see. Are you telling me how to do comedy? Mm-hmm. And I said, in this one case, I am. And he goes, you. And I'm like, okay, but we're going to do it, right? He goes, oh, all right. And then he does it. And he goes, oh, yeah, it's pretty good. Better, a little better that way. And I'm like, okay. Next line. And it was, you know, it was rough. But it was also Chevy Chase, who I'm like, I mean, who doesn't love Chevy Chase?
I think, too, once you understand kind of his disposition and the way he works, it's probably a lot easier.
Well, he was exactly the same. Burt Reynolds and he were the same in the sense that they both committed to their art form with physicality. So all those falls Chevy did they caused him to have like major back pain, and he became addicted to painkillers, and so did Burt. And when they were on those painkillers, they couldn't remember lines.
Ah, it makes sense.
And they would lash out. And then, you know, some things got a little rough for, you know, if you're an extra walking by, God help you. Yeah. Like it was stuff that, like punching down. It was, none of it was good. But, I, you know, look, I still love Chevy Chase, but I witnessed him being mean. And sometimes to me, but not, you know, what do I care?
Which is like, there's never any reason for that, right? Because we're all on a team working towards the same thing.
I always say, if you can't have fun in show business, you're in the wrong goddamn business.
Don't do it.
Yeah. I mean, because boy, is it fun.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, who has more fun than us?
Right, right. Well, as we start to wind down, I'm assuming this is a much more fun set. I'm a huge Arrested Development fan, one of my all-time favorite shows. You directed quite a few episodes of that. Kind of talk about being on that set and how that was. Because it was such a quirky, weird... You know, it's like a prog rock Rush song of a television show. Nothing of it really makes sense, but it's so genius.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the first episode was the pilot. I saw that, and my friends, the Russo brothers, made that. And, excuse me, they brought me in to meet the creator, Mitch Hurwitz. And, you know, I'll tell you this, that pilot won an Emmy.
Jeez.
It was like, you watched it. You're like, oh, this is an excellent show.
Yeah.
Excellent show. Everybody in it is excellent. The writing is top notch and the performances are incredible.
Yeah.
I said that to the creator and I said, I got one note. And he goes, and I said, you know, I think you cut it too quickly. And he goes, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, you have an internal rhythm, which is, you know, these jokes are landing in the, you know, I can see your rhythm. He goes, I got my own rhythm. It's similar. You're running a little faster. I said, but what you end up have done is you're cutting to each line to create the rhythm. I said, if I were you, I would put two actors who have lines back to back in the same frame and have them create the same exact rhythm, so you just have to cut less.
About the edit, yeah.
And he goes, and he was from the world of multicam. He was on Golden Girls. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a great, fantastic writer, this guy, Mitch Hurwitz. He goes, I understand what you're saying, but I don't understand what the execution of that would look like. And I said, okay, well, he goes, why don't you just make one and show me? So I shot one, and I tried to reduce the number of cuts while keeping what I believed was his rhythm. And he looked at it, he goes, yeah, okay, that's it. And so it's not that, you know, the beauty of coming into a show early, and I came in like episode 4, is that you get to be part of the evolution of the show. Like the Russo brothers, again, they won an Emmy for this thing. It's great. The pilot's great. But then we just started to use more wide shots and have, okay, Everybody's like, there's six people in the scene. You all have lines, and we got to say them boom, ba boom, ba boom, ba boom, ba boom. Whoever pauses, we're cutting away.
Yeah.
And you're trying to create. It's like what Woody Allen did. Again, I'm like, you know, I'm against some things Woody Allen did. But what he did do also was he had his rhythm on screen. He had 3-minute takes where like the rhythm is his rhythm, but it's the actors are creating it. And so I got to do that. And it was really an incredible experience because you're like, we're making the greatest television show on, I mean, greatest show on TV. That nobody's watching.
Yeah.
Because our ratings were so low.
Yeah.
And you're like, God, this is, I mean, not my problem, but ultimately we were just, everybody who was on that show was like, this is the best show on TV. Mm-hmm. I wish somebody would watch it. And, but, you know, I got to work with, you know, Bateman and Arnett and, you know, Cross and, I mean, it was magical. And the mother, you know, she's just the funniest of all time. Yeah. Right. It was magical. And the guy, you know, I mean, it was so magical. Like everybody on that show, we're all, you know, Michael Cera and, you know, like we're still friendly because of that.
It did find an audience eventually.
Which was cool. Became huge.
Yeah, it became huge for a bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Last few things for you. What was your favorite thing about returning to the Super Troopers universe and getting number three done?
Well, it's fun to grow a mustache and get a crew cut and then put on that outfit.
Yeah.
Because you're kind of like, wait, am I a cop? Like, I think I might be a cop. And for a while, you're walking around with a fake gun and a badge and you're like, yeah, I'm a cop. And it's really quite, you know, you fall and you see the other guys around and you're like, oh, they look like the characters who I know, and I'm, you know, and you react very naturally to these people. Mm. And there's Brian Cox who plays our chief, you know, like I'm always amazed that, you know, when you're acting with Brian Cox, you're like, God, he's right there.
Yeah.
It's like in the scene with me. and you're always like, that's what a good actor is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there's us. but it's fantastic. It's fun. It's quick. We also know in our guts what has worked in the past and what should work in the future. Mm-hmm. And that's what movie making is. You're gambling that these are the scenes you should shoot. And when you cut it all together, it's a lot of, yep, I was right about this, or I was wrong about this, so it's out of the movie. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what the whole thing of editing is.
Right.
I was right, I was right, I was right, I was wrong, I was wrong, I was right, and you go, that's the movie.
Mm-hmm. That's the beauty of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just get rid of the wrong stuff.
Yeah.
Last question. Who's your favorite actor that you've ever directed? Because you've had some real big names that you've worked with. Is there one that stands out for you?
I have to say, God, you're right. I mean, Cloris Leachman was wonderful, but I think it might be Rob Lowe.
Really?
You know, like, he was in a show called The Grinder with Fred Savage. And The Grindr is a famous gay dating website.
Yeah.
And I said to the writers, I'm like, guys, this show's phenomenal, but change the title. And they're like, no, it's not about a gay website. It's about a guy who's a lawyer who grinds. And I'm like, I know that. You know that. But change the damn title. They're like, we feel people will get it. I'm like, okay. They didn't get it. But it was a great show.
Yeah.
And the beauty of that show was that Fred Savage and Rob Lowe are like, I mean, they're youngish, but they're old time performers. They've been around it so long that they know that they come to set, they know every word. They know every word of theirs. They know every word of yours. And so Fred and Rob would get into these little scenes and I'd shoot the two shot and it would be 3.5 straight minutes of perfection, perfect timing. And I was like, you know, I'd shoot one take. I'd be like, you know, I could put that on TV.
Yeah,
I said, we're not gonna, because I know that they want to see the coverage. We'd shoot it. We'd shoot the coverage. And they would use it. That's fine. It's their show. But you could. And I said to Rob Lowe, I'm like, I'm impressed. And he goes, well, the only way you get to be where I am and still working is, and he's the one who said this term, he says, like, by being an assassin. He goes, you have to be the most prepared of anybody, anywhere, every time. And he goes, you show up and you know everything and you're ready and you have a comment, you have a thought about this emotion, that emotion. And I was like, yeah. He goes, West Wing, seven assassins. He goes, that's why it works.
Right. It's great. Great point.
Yeah.
Well, it's awesome talking to you, Jay. And congratulations on Super Troopers 3. And maybe we'll have to unwrap Screwjob again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Call Peter Hoare.
Yeah, we'll get him going.
Thanks, man.
Thank you. Appreciate it.